Support for The Full Story comes from Long Wharf Theater, creating theater of, for, and by the people of Greater New Haven. Everyone's story has a place at Long Wharf. You belong.
The tip jar just got a bit fuller. Restaurant employees in Connecticut and a variety of customer service workers in New York will be able to earn their tips and make at least a minimum wage. This is The Full Story on WSHU. I'm Rebecca Saran in for Ron Ropiak. Well, we're going to talk about working for tips and the minimum wage in our region. And later, class is in session, and it's all about happiness. But first, last week in Connecticut, Governor Ned Lamont signed into law legislation to resolve an ongoing legal issue concerning wages earned by restaurant employees. The law was approved by state lawmakers in a one-day special session after months of contentious debate from tip workers and restaurant owners. Joining me now is Scott Dolch. He is the executive director of the Connecticut Restaurant Association. Scott, welcome to The Full Story.
Thanks, Rebecca. I appreciate you having me today.
Yeah, tell me, what was that issue here, and why was the legislation required?
Sure. I guess just to kind of do it quickly and kind of understand if everybody here on the radio listening is, we've, as a state, for decades through the Connecticut Department of Labor, have issued just the 80-20 rule, which means 80% of the time of a server or bartender, they need to be servicing their customers, and 20% of that time, no more than 20%, can they be doing side work. That are guidelines and the policies that have been provided by the DOL for, like I said, for well over, we know, over 10 years. We even have guidelines that provided as most recent as 2018 that had that. The issue is there was a state regulation that actually contradicted that that policy, where you actually had to segregate all time, and which would have almost been impossible in a restaurant, that a server would have had to go and clock out of a server wage and go cut maybe a lime or a lemon, clock in at a minimum wage to do that, clock back out, clock in probably 80, 100 times. That's why the 80-20 rule is also a federal rule during the Obama administration. So all we really did with this compromise language is working with the DOL to get us back to that status quo of 80-20, so restaurants and servers and bartenders, as everyone's really fully protected, to continue to follow and have that tip wage that we do have in Connecticut for both servers and bartenders. So realistically, it's not changing anything. It's really just clarifying and repealing kind of a regulation that contradicts kind of the roles and what has been told by the DOL to my members for years.
So with the 80-20 rule, at 80%, it's at the tip wage. At 20%, you're paid minimum wage. Is that how it works?
No, it's actually the time. So as long as if they work a 6-hour shift, 80% of their time has to be serviceable work. They can't go over 20%. Otherwise, they can't take the tip wage. So it just has to do the timing, the percentage of their time has to be, they can't, like, let's say, you know, just do side work in the back and never take service tables for 50% of their time. They wouldn't be allowed to take that tip wage. They wouldn't be allowed to, they'd have to pay them the $11. That's the current minimum wage in Connecticut. So realistically, it's just a baseline of time of what, how much side work, but realistically in most restaurants, the side work time, it's very quick. It, you know, could be 30 seconds, 15 seconds over a 5 minute of servicing tables. So it's not a long-winded time, but over 6 hours, they might do it 70, 80 times at 15, 30 seconds. And they need to make sure that time, that 20% of their, if, you know, sometimes it's even like 8 or 10%, but it's not exceeding 20%. If it exceeds 20%, you in Connecticut as a restaurateur cannot have the servers take the tip wage or the bartender wage, if that makes a little bit more sense.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds confusing, and I don't know how many restaurants really follow it because there's so many elements to it. So what was the position of restaurant owners on this?
Restaurant owners are obviously in support of the compromise language, obviously, you know, working, you know, for months with the governor's office, legislative leaders on both sides of the aisle, and really just explaining, hey, this is what the DOL had been providing for years. This is what our restaurants have been following. And what really sparked this was these lawsuits that were coming out because, you know, the state regulation contradicted this DOL language. And that's really where, you know, the scary pieces were, you know, these restaurants were being sued even though they were following guidelines that the DOL had been providing them. And so realistically, to get, you know, everyone in a room and just say, listen, we're just trying to go back to status quo. We're trying to, continue to run these restaurants for the protection not only of the restaurateurs, but for the servers and bartenders to have this flexibility, to have, you know, the opportunity. Because when you talk about the tip wage, yes, it's their base wage at $6.38, but they receive tips above that. and to be able to have that and that opportunity and flexibility where they're making on average $25 in our state on average per hour is what a server and bartender is making. So that flexibility and making sure they understood that, we're very supportive of getting this language across because it was protecting on the legality, because you had a state regulation that really contradicted not what we have been telling people, but what the DOL had been telling us for years.
So is that the state said, you know, this is not a big deal to the restaurant owners. Don't worry. You don't need to keep detailed records. This all kind of washes out in the end.
Well, no, there still needs to be that you know, the detailed records, the policies, the procedures, the guidelines that DOL has provided. The thing that was the unique piece was it really the segregation of time, where the state regulation had said you must segregate all time. You must, you know, and you cannot, you know, realistically you need them to go to a POS system almost 80 to 100 times during a shift for every server, every bartender that you have. And that realistically, you know, when they came in with their wage and hour auditors, you know, that was not what they were providing and following and telling how restaurants to do. And no one here is trying to take advantage by any means of any employees in that process. But it was really the fear that was going out with how judges were ruling on this, because, you know, even though guidelines were saying, hey, you can do this and you're okay because, and you've been audited and you've been cleared of an audit, you still could be sued. And that's really why we needed this legislation to clear that up, because, you know, the legal, you know, these are small business owners to have to go down a legal battle when they were following these guidelines are thousands to hundreds of thousands, and even to a couple of cases have gotten up to close to millions of dollars for following guidelines that they thought were the ones, you know, that DOL had been providing them. So that was really the biggest, you know, issue we had throughout this, and explaining, hey, we're not trying to change how the DOL has been monitoring restaurants. We want to continue, we think, but at the same time, we have to clear up the legislative language and the legality of the law to make sure it coincides with it.
So we're speaking now with Scott Dolch of the Connecticut Restaurant Association about changes to how much tip earners can make. If you'd like to comment on today's show, you can email us at tfs@wshu.org or message us on Facebook at Full Story WSHU. So in light of the new legislation and the governor signing it, how can a worker hold an employer or a restaurant owner accountable if they feel like they're not being paid what they're supposed to be paid?
Well, I think the biggest thing is every way that they've always been able to do that. I think if they feel they're taken advantage of, like any employee in any industry in our state, there's ways that they can go and do that. They can file, obviously, a claim to the Connecticut Department of Labor. They can file a claim to DRS on certain cases. They can file a claim to CHRO. There are always going to be ways, and I think that's the biggest thing. I think people need to understand when we started this process for the last couple months is, realistically, my job is to represent the entire industry, and the benefit that tipped employees and servers and bartenders have in our state. You know, you guys obviously talked a little bit about New York with Governor Cuomo, obviously keeping the tip wage there in New York, which was obviously, we really appreciate that he understands that, you know, having the tip wage at $6.38 in our state, and we are the only state with a bartender wage of $8.23, it allows a small business owner like a restaurant where, yes, they can pay that base wage, and then the tips on top of that allow them to make well over minimum wage. I mean, on average, $25. So we're not even at 15, we're at 11. The average is 25. They're making well over. They're the highest earners in our industry. And, you know, they're looking as small business owners working off of 3 to 5% profit margins. So if you were to eliminate that tip credit, you know, in a lot of cases, a lot of restaurants would have gone out of business. You're seeing that in Seattle. You're seeing that out in California with some of the challenges. And we are 80% of our restaurants in our state are independently owned. We're not big chains, and they're trying to do their best every day. And this to just blow up that process, I think we really appreciate the support even during this session of the legislators, you know, going to $15, yes, but to freeze and decouple our tip wages where they are, because they're already, Rebecca, $2 on average higher than any other state in New England, you know, at $6.38, and obviously not even talking about the bartender wage at $8.23. So that process and the flexibility that comes with that with servers and bartenders is what makes our industry so great. And I think that's something we continue to talk about, you know, here on the radio or up with legislation and everything else. That my job is to really protect the industry as a whole. We have 160,000 employees that work in the food service industry in Connecticut.
But some waiters and waitresses, especially waitresses, say with the tip wage plus tips, They have to please everyone to get the tips that they would make up that difference. They have to please the customers. They have to please the owners. They have to please the chefs. And having to please everybody puts them in a vulnerable position, all the way from the way they act to the way they dress. What's your response?
Well, listen, I think in any position, any job, you obviously have bosses, you have, you know, customers, you have to, you know, perform. And I think that doesn't take away from what position or what you do. I think the unique side when you look at servers and bartenders is the flexibility that comes with that position. That they're, you know, if you look at in cases of Maine or Washington, D.C., when they've tried to eliminate tipping, like they did try to do in D.C. a year and a half ago, it wasn't the restaurant owners. It was these servers that were up there screaming from the rooftop saying, don't take our tips. You know, we want to have this flexibility. There's no other industry where, you know, you can go and make, you know, $25 an hour and can also pick your shifts and maybe be a single parent and have an opportunity to take care of your kids, you know, and work their flexibility of shifts, maybe be going, trying to go to school and be a bartender at night, to have that flexibility to make an income like that on a short term window. So understanding that process, I think, is something that we talk about all the time, but they're protected. Every server and bartender in our state is protected to get to $11. If there was a snowstorm and they were working and they're making $6.38 when they clocked in or clocked out and they weren't paid, they are federally and state protected and they can take that to a lawsuit, and I will help support them in that. They're making minimum wage, but they're making well above that, without question. But understanding that too, that we really still are talking about, a class of employees that are making minimum wage. Obviously, the model of how they get there, 99% of the time, is through tips. But okay, They're still protected every time they walk in to do their job, that they're now making, you know, at minimum $11 an hour.
All right, Scott Dulch,
12, so.
The executive director of the Connecticut Restaurant Association. Thanks for joining us. And you are listening to The Full Story. We'll take a break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Saran in for Ron Ropiak. 30 years ago, New York grouped together several customer service industries to allow employers to pay tipped workers below the state minimum wage, but only if they made enough tips to make up the difference. A recent State Department of Labor investigation found some businesses robbed workers of, quote, a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. Now, several kinds of customer service workers can look forward to making at least the minimum wage plus tips. Joining me now is David Wixer, labor economist at Stony Brook University, and Ben Zipperer. He is an economist at the Economic Policy Institute. Gentlemen, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for having us on.
All right, the Governor Cuomo, is passionate about this. Says he wants to prevent outright wage theft experienced in these industries. Tell us about what these new regulations would do exactly. We can start with you, David.
Yeah, so this is going to mean that some occupations that used to not be under minimum wage regulation will now have to pay all of the workers at least minimum wage. With the exception of restaurant servers, which is an interesting carve-out.
I do find that interesting, Ben, because they're the largest group when it comes to tip earners. Why were restaurant workers carved out? Ben?
Sorry. Yeah, so I think restaurant workers were carved out because that's a common political compromise that we see in the United States around minimum wage legislation. One way that the restaurant industry has been able to avoid paying decent wages is by lowering wages for certain employers through a carve-out for tipped employees.
So how will this be rolled out, David, this new legislation?
So I think by rolled out, you mean, like, what's the effect going to be?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I mean, often when we think about kind of the effect of changes in minimum wage regulation, we look at kind of two aspects of this. So one is that you just directly increase the wages of certain workers. And the other is that it potentially has an effect on employment. So to the first, it's almost kind of obvious that people who used to be getting paid less than minimum wage will now have a wage increase. The other one, which is kind of an offsided fear that this is going to reduce the employment of people who are covered, empirically that tends to not be the case, actually. So there's really good evidence going back to kind of restaurant workers in New Jersey, and then recent work by the New York Fed saying that places that experience an increase in the minimum wage, really it doesn't affect much how much employers are willing to hire people.
Is that because they pass those costs along to customers and consumers?
I mean, some of it. So the increase in the labor cost is going to somewhat show up in prices and somewhat show up in profits. But also, it's not that many workers when you think about it. So the incremental change in the wages isn't super high.
And Ben, what role does gender and race play in the tipping economy?
Yeah, I'd be happy to answer that. And I just wanted to agree, I think, with what David was saying, and just to add a separate point that's correct, that I think one of the reasons why you see mainly beneficial effects of minimum wage increases and not many negative employment effects is that, yes, some of those costs are passed on to consumers and some of them come out of reductions in profits. But also, businesses save a bit when minimum wages are raised because it reduces worker turnover. So workers are much less likely to leave their job, and it's easier for businesses to hire workers when wages are increased through the minimum wage. And regarding gender and race, minimum wages actually have disproportionately positive effects for women and for people of color, primarily because in the U.S. economy, women and people of color are paid relatively low wages, so they stand to benefit the most from minimum wage increases.
If you're just tuning in, we're discussing the minimum wage in New York. And in New York, the minimum wage increased $1 at the beginning of the year. Long Islanders and Westchester County residents will now make $13 an hour. And the entire state is on track to reach $15 minimum wage by 2021. Connecticut's going to phase in a $15 an hour wage by 2023. We're speaking with Stony Brook University labor economist David Wixer and Ben Zipper from the Economic Policy Institute. I think, Ben, it was your point that, or maybe you, David, in terms of employers end up saving when the minimum wage is increased. I think that's what your point was. How does this impact, though, benefits that they might offer? Healthcare coverage, retirement benefits, paid leave?
So that was actually Ben's point about employers benefit from this. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I think is important to note about changes in the minimum wage, which gets to your question, is that overall pay packages and income inequality is about a lot more than just the wage. So for instance, especially at the bottom of the income distribution, a lot of the differences in take-home pay are not coming from differences in wages; they're coming from differences in hours. So when you ask this question about how is the total compensation package going to change, on the one hand, wages for these covered workers are going to go up. On the other hand, it's not going to change this kind of fundamental issue, which is that a lot of the reason why there's relatively poor households isn't only that they get low wages, it's that they have fewer hours than maybe they would want. And then, you can extrapolate that sort of a statement to and also not having access to benefits and all the niceties of kind of more stable, higher earning employment.
Some of our listeners, Ben, may say, if you raise the minimum wage an extra dollar, a couple dollars, really, what kind of an impact does that have on a worker's quality of life? How would you respond to that?
I think just to bridge what David was saying and maybe what critics of small minimum wage increases might say. It is true that, raising the minimum wage a dollar isn't going to, suddenly cause workers to take control of the labor market and have a worker-led revolution. But it can make a meaningful difference in pay. So, for example, if a worker, works full-time throughout the year at the minimum wage and you raise the minimum wage a dollar, that's an extra $2,000 a year. Or if they work, half that amount during the year, that's an extra $1,000 a year. And that can make an enormous difference in the lives of low-wage workers whose lives because of their low pay are extremely precarious. It can make it easier to afford a car payment, not to miss rent, be able to, you know, afford that last bit of food for your family. So even though some of these hourly wage increases tend to sound small, they actually have meaningful and measurably significant impacts on the lives of low-wage workers.
And I think from your institute, the minimum wage has gone up in 22 states. 7 million low-wage employees affected by the increases will earn an extra $8.2 billion over the course of the year. Significant difference. Gentlemen, we want to thank you so much for joining us today, sharing your insights on the minimum wage, tipped earners, and how it overall affects the economy as well as individual lives.
Thanks very much. This was fun.
Thank you.
All right. You've been listening to David Wixer. He is a labor economist at Stony Brook University. Also joining us today, Ben Zipperer. He is an economist at the Economic Policy Institute. They've been with us as we've looked at these big changes in both New York and in Connecticut. And coming up, we're going to talk a little bit about happiness and how happiness can affect your overall well-being and how exactly you get there to become a happier person. You're listening to The Full Story on WSHU. If you want to join in the conversation, email us at tfs@wshu.org or message us on Facebook at Full Story WSHU. You can listen to our podcasts on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. So we are going to get deep. How do you find happiness in your life? And here's a tougher question. How do you define happiness? A Yale University professor with a brand new podcast tries to answer those questions by bringing the classroom to life. Dr. Lori Santos teaches the most popular class at Yale in over 300 years. Nearly one out of every four students take the course, which is called Psychology and the Good Life. Dr. Santos, welcome to The Full Story.
Thanks so much for having me on.
I think you were even shocked initially by how popular your class became, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was the first time that class was ever taught, you know, and what's typical at Yale is, you know, around 30 or 40 students take the class. So when we were starting to have to teach the class in a concert hall and we're, you know, passing 1,000 students on our wait list, you know, it was not what I expected. It was pretty surreal.
Well, also with us today is Tracy George. She is the director of the Yale Well Initiative and the Good Life Center. This is Yale's first student wellness center. The class sounds right up your alley, Tracy. How did the two of you, are you involved?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's been really wonderful to partner with Lori the last couple years since the class to have the class come to life in the form of this wellness center at Yale. Since I had been a graduate student in the School of Public Health, I'd been thinking about student wellness on campus a long time and was really grateful to be part of Lori's class, lead meditation for hundreds of students at once. And then we decided to keep joining forces and make this place happen.
Well, let's start at the very beginning. How do each of you define happiness? Lori, I'll start with you.
Yeah, well, I usually use the social scientist definition of happiness, which is often a definition of well-being. Well-being is sort of being happy in your life and with your life. And that means that you have to be satisfied with your life, which is what researchers call kind of cognitive well-being. You have to think your life is going well. It's really the answer to the question, all things considered, how satisfied are you with your life? But you also have to be happy in your life. And that means having, you know, a lot of positive emotions. And it means having less, though not no, negative emotions. You need some to be happy. But it means kind of experiencing things like joy and tranquility and so on. And so most of the research tries to measure both of these, tries to measure how satisfied you are with your life and what your emotions are like in your life. And if you maximize both of those, most people would self-report that they're feeling pretty happy.
And Tracy, what do you tell students when they ask you, what is happiness?
So I'm coming from a mindfulness background, which is awareness of all things that arise, whether they are pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral feelings. So happiness, and also how I define wellness, is really holding everything that comes up, from joy to suffering and everything in between. So the work's really focused on helping students meet what comes up, whether that's anxiety, depression, loneliness, and also excitement, motivation, really joy for life. So it encompasses everything.
So why are we seeing, Lori, in today's world, so much anxiety, stress, ultimately unhappiness?
Yeah, I mean, the why question is the million-dollar question right now. I mean, what we know unambiguously is the fact that all of these mental health issues have skyrocketed, and they've skyrocketed really recently. In the last 9 years, the number of young people who report being very depressed has doubled in just the last 9 years. Why that is a tricky question. I mean, people point fingers at things like technology, the fact that we're not as socially connected in real life as we've ever been, you know, the fact that things like social media allow for social comparisons and so on. I think the young people today have enormous stress about the kinds of jobs they want to get, getting into a good school and so on. I think there are lots and lots of different factors, but a lot of them can be summed up with the notion that we talk a lot about in the class and in my new podcast, this idea that we go after the wrong things. We have certain intuitions about the kinds of things that are going to make us happy, but those intuitions are wrong. My students think that they should put their social relationships on hold so they can study for a big test to get the perfect internship or to get the perfect job, but that's exactly the wrong strategy. They think they should forego their own balance and self-care, even in terms of things like sleep and exercise, you know, to get perfect grades. And that, it turns out, is wrong. What's the big problem is that we seem to be going about it the wrong way. We're going after happiness. We're just kind of doing it wrong.
Do you think happiness can be acquired? Or, I mean, so often you can see an individual and they just have a sparkle in their eye, a smile on their face. They're always like that. They're just kind of genetically hardwired for happy. Is happiness acquired or inherited?
Well, I think in some ways the good news is that it's both. You know, it would be bad news if happiness was just kind of built in. I guess it would be good news for the people who are genetically happy, but not such good news for those of us who need to work at it. There is a heritable component to happiness that comes from work with twins and looking at the biology of happiness. But that heritable component is pretty small. It's probably less than half of our well-being seems to be built in. And that's really good news because it means that happiness can be acquired. It's the kind of thing we can work at. But again, the problem is that we seem to go about it the wrong way. We often think happiness requires changing our circumstances, changing our job, you know, changing our relationship, you know, changing our life around. It's not that. It's really changing our mindsets and changing our behaviors. That's what the research shows can really allow us to acquire happiness.
I mean, Tracy, how do you convey those messages of happiness and how to achieve it to students in such an intensely competitive environment?
Yeah, there are a number of ways that we play with doing this. And I think one of the most important is the physical space that we've created in this Good Life Center that, again, is this manifestation, this physical manifestation of the lessons and the evidence of the class, of being able to walk into a space that does not feel like a strict academic environment, but uses some of these principles of nudge, of supplying things around a room that students can enter a space and feel like there's a meditation cushion for them, there's a yoga mat for them, there's a place for them to hang out with their friends. And so the environment itself supports the behaviors that we want to see and that we know evidence shows us supports happiness over time. So it's what I call like passive programming, of just having spaces where students can experience that for themselves. And then we also do more active programming where we have different partners and experts from around Yale's campus come in and lead different types of workshops. Some are called mental health empowerment or mindfulness classes, meditation groups, where we're doing more direct skill building with students. As Lori said, it's something that we can build and work on over time, just like strength training in the gym. We can strength train our own minds and hearts to be able to learn some of these coping skills. So sitting with students in the various parts of their experience, whether that's hard or joyful, everything in between, and the space is really important to them.
Yeah, Lori, how do we get that message across and also change the way of thinking? We all think if we have X, we're going to be happy. But you say research shows quite the opposite. If we're happy, that often leads to positive results.
Yeah, that's, I think, you know, for me, when I first started getting into this research, sort of the biggest shock, right, is that we think, you know, you get these circumstances and it leads to happiness. But the research suggests us the opposite. Students who are happy in middle school and high school end up having salaries that are higher 30 years later. People who are happy at their job when they first start end up performing better than people who report self-report being not so happy at their job when they first start. And so it seems like maybe we should be focusing on happiness first. Like maybe that's the causal arrow for achieving a lot of the other kinds of things we want in life, you know, good relationships, you know, happy jobs, higher salaries, and so on. How we convince people of that is tricky because, again, this really violates their intuition. I mean, I'm the professor that teaches this class, and it violates my intuition. And I think that's where the science can really help in learning about the science. You know, once you see these studies, once you see this evidence and all the graphs and things, you know, it's really hard to say, well, oh, I should change my circumstances. You see the evidence and you think, oh, wait, no, I need to start focusing on happiness first. I'm doing it wrong.
And are these fairly resilient people then?
I mean, the research suggests that happiness builds in all kinds of positive coping strategies, and the seeds of happiness build these kinds of things in too. So being a person who tends to be really grateful, you tend to show a lot more resilience. You tend to show a lot more self-control, you know, the kinds of things that are involved in eating healthier, you know, being the kind of person that gets up and exercises.
All right. We're going to take a break. Sorry to interrupt, but we'll be back with Lori Santos and Tracy George after a break. You're part of the full story on WSHU. I'm Rebecca Saran in for Ron Ropiak. We're talking to Dr. Lori Santos. She teaches the most popular class at Yale that they've ever had. It's all about living a good, fulfilling life. It's offered for free online as well. More than 450,000 people have enrolled. She also wrapped up season one of her podcast, The Happiness Lab. It explores what it takes to be happy with a handful of guests, including one really unhappy millionaire and the founder of the Museum of Ice Cream. Yes, one exists. Lori, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
We hang on to this idea that money can buy us happiness, and it's proved wrong over and over again. Why do though we still pursue the almighty dollar, thinking that's going to make our life so much happier?
Well, I think it's partly that it's not the case that money doesn't buy happiness. If you're living below the poverty line and you increase your wealth, yes, you're going to get a lot happier. The problem is that connection, we then make the intuition that, well, at any salary level, more money is going to make us happier. And that's what's not really the case. People really double down thinking that if they improve their salary, they're going to get happier. And research suggests that in the U.S. right now, that might be true if you're earning under $70,000 or so. But once you hit a level of around 70, 75K, improving your salary is not going to improve your happiness. Now, that's not what we think, but that's what the research really suggests.
And the research shows that the richest of us all feel trapped, therefore we're unhappy.
I think that's the biggest irony, right, is that as you get more money, you're not as happy as you think. And rather than reject the intuition that money matters for happiness, you say, well, I must just not have enough yet. You know, so people who are, you know, millionaires think, well, I have to, you know, be a 100 millionaire. I have to become a billionaire. That's what I'm going to need. And so that's the real irony, is that rather than reject the notion that money matters, we just think, oh, I just need more. I just need that one more bump up in my salary and then I'll get there. But that notion is just wrong.
Also with us today from Yale is Tracy George. She is the director of the Good Life Center, the Student Wellness Center at Yale University. And we talked in the previous blog, Tracy, about students today and what you're seeing at Yale. And this is what you're seeing broadly across college campuses today. And that is the rapidly increasing level of severe depression and suicidal thinking. Why is that?
So there are a lot of factors that play into this, and as Lori's been talking about, a lot of the pressure that comes from students driving at things that really don't lead to their health, wellness, and happiness. What we see a lot at Yale, and again, it's not just Yale specific, but students driving at high grades, packing their resume, really high achieving level, type A, that drives them towards things that are really draining them. And so we see a lot of chronic stress over time that really wears down on the body, and this leads to all sorts of health issues. And so there's also a sense of detachment and loneliness that comes up with students. As much as we know that social media is connecting students in a certain way, they also feel very isolated, and that disconnection can lead to anxiety, depression, and more feelings of disconnect from their community that is really supportive.
You bring up a good point, Lori. There was a a shift in the country in terms of thinking, I don't know, maybe late 80s, early 90s, where we kind of shifted from thinking about social movements to then turning to self-help, self-improvement, self-care, kind of turning inward. But that shift, research is showing that the real happiness is really found by turning to the outside world as opposed to turning inward. Is that not right?
Yeah, that's correct. This is yet another spot where I think our minds lead us astray, you know, especially at this time of year, in the beginning of the year, there's a lot of, you know, treat yourself, self-care, self. The research suggests that happy people are well-connected. The one thing that predicts high happiness is your strong social relationships, the strongest correlate. Another thing that predicts high happiness is the fact that you're other-oriented. You're focused on doing nice things for other people. You're not kind of treating out your own salary, and in the case of my students, your own grades. You're out there trying to do nice things for others, focused on their feelings. Again, we kind of get it wrong. We focus on ourselves when really it's connection that seems to breed higher well-being.
And we just want, for those listeners at home who are, you know, grappling with depression, we do have a text line, and that is, you can text HOME, H-O-M-E, to 741-741, and that'll take you to the crisis text line. If you know someone or yourself who perhaps has thoughts of suicide or is facing severe depression. Tracy, let's get back to the students and social media, and how that is impacting their world. I mean, they all seem to love it. They are all on their phones all the time. How is that affecting the way they think about themselves and their overall happiness?
Well, there's definitely a difference between the instant gratification that might come from a post being liked or seeing pictures of your friends or posting something online. Difference between that and then really feeling deeply connected, seen, and heard by friendships where there's in-person interaction, a good amount of time spent, deeper conversations where they can share what's going on in their lives. And I think the social media really feeds a sense of imposter syndrome. And we see that a lot at Yale, other schools as well, where students feel like everyone else deserves to be somewhere or belongs there, but they're the only one that doesn't because everyone seems like they're doing so great. And I'm sure we all have this experience of scrolling through Facebook and seeing the most beautiful images of people's lives and the most beautiful updates and wondering, well, my life doesn't feel that beautiful and perfect. What's wrong with me? So this internalized question, again, moving away from the realities of connection and love and friendship to what's wrong with me. And so I think that's a major part that feeds into that. And so trying to encourage students to connect with each other in person, not just over a text. Even calling is kind of rare for students, right? Of actually to pick up the phone and call somebody. So being able to create spaces or programming or facilitate students sitting down together and talking in a meditation group about what came up that week, what was that like, when I felt panicked, when I felt stressed, when I didn't get that grade I wanted. And that tends to feel more connected with each other so they don't feel so alone.
And Lori, social media and so many of the apps and the gadgets, they benchmark us. You know, how many likes do you have? How many followers do you have? How many steps did you take? Even all the way down to the basics of how good are your grades? How is that impacting our pursuit of happiness?
Yeah, well, this is another spot where we might be inadvertently messing with the normal mechanisms we have to achieve happiness. Research shows that what motivates us is our internal motivations, you know, that just we run for the sake of loving the running rather than wanting to get our step count out. You know, it's fun to like learn something in school. You know, you love math or you love social studies. You're not doing it for a grade. What the research shows, and this is really old research from the 1950s, is that as soon as you slap a grade, as soon as you slap some external motivation on something you love to do, you stop loving it as much. And I mean, I'm sure all of us have had this experience when, you know, you're doing something you love and then you start doing it either for a job or because you have to do it, and then all of a sudden it stops feeling as fun. We are constantly doing that to ourselves with all the pleasures we get out there, from, you know, sharing a photo with a friend to exercising to even in some cases to meditation. I mean, there are apps that kind of rate you on meditation now. And we're willingly doing this with this technology, and it's actually reducing the enjoyment we would normally get from our daily activities.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the road to happiness and a good life with Yale's Dr. Lori Santos and Tracy George. Now, email us at tfs@wshu.org or message us on Facebook at Full Story WSHU if you'd like to join in the conversation. I know, Tracy, there's one road to happiness that every age group needs to follow, but we also are also challenged by it, and that is enjoy the process. Enjoy every moment. Live in the moment. How do you take that lesson and teach college students about it?
Part of that is helping them build confidence in themselves that they can get through even the tough moments. So it's a combination of that, of sitting with what's hard and building the resilience in themselves that, oh, I can get through something difficult and this moment is okay. And then also using mindfulness skills that we know really well to turn our attention towards what is beautiful and joyful about any given moment. So being present doesn't always mean feeling good, but being present means I can do this. I can enjoy this. I can do this. I can get through this. And so using, you know, evidence-based practices around mindfulness that we know for decades have been supporting people through everything from chronic pain, chronic illness, to stress, depression, and anxiety. So building that internal sense of structure and support within each individual student, and then creating communities of students, groups of friends that feel like they can support each other in being in the moment with whatever's there.
You know, Lori, that's one of the things that I took away from a number of your podcasts, and that is some of the people who had the most devastating life events, the events that you feel like you just really wouldn't even be able to get up the next day from, tend to be some of the happiest people out there. Why is that?
Yeah, well, I think in some ways, the circumstances of our lives don't matter in the way we think. You know, we often put amazing events in our life, you know, winning the lottery or, you know, meeting the perfect partner, you know, marrying the perfect person. We assume that those things will make us happy, that they will make us happy forever. But in practice, that's just not the case. The good thing is the same is true for negative events. We assume if we lost our job, you know, if we had a breakup, you know, if we were in a disfiguring car accident, that it would be game over, that we'd never be happy again. But the research shows when you actually talk to people who've had these things happen, it's not even just that they're resilient and still happy in the face of these awful events. They're sometimes even grateful that these awful events happen. You know, you can talk to people who've, you know, lost a spouse, or, you know, lost the use of their legs. And what they'll say is that, you know, often more better things happened through that event than worse things, which is truly remarkable. We have this amazing psychological immune system that allows us to take bad things in our life and see the good things, to be grateful for these things. We just forget that we have that wonderful superpower, and that means we don't use it as much as we should.
Is it hard for us to kind of clear through all the noise in today's world? And I know you have one of the podcasts that focuses on choices. We have so many choices today that oftentimes it leads us to feel unhappy, not satisfied. We can't even make, let's say, a choice on a streaming movie. How is that impacting our feelings?
I think we forget that our freedom is sometimes our downside. You know, these days we have enormous freedom about everything, you know, what we choose to eat, what we choose to watch on Netflix. I can be entertained in a million different ways just by picking up my phone. But we forget that that sort of freedom has this enormous cost, which is that can be exhausting. You know, even the act of, you know, where I'm going to, you know, what I'm going to, radio station I'm going to listen to, what podcast I'm going to listen to. These things are choices that make us feel a little bit overwhelmed. And the research suggests counterintuitively that we can help ourselves by trying to limit some of our options. You know, only ever listen to NPR or only ever listen to the Happiness Lab. You know, it's sort of joking, but by limiting your choices, you can actually free your mind to focus on the present things that will make you happier.
Yeah, Tracy, are you finding that young people recognize this, that perhaps all the choices they have in today's world isn't contributing to their happiness at all? I think many of them think, oh, this is an old person problem. They just can't figure it out. You know, they don't know technology. They're not on board with streaming. But in fact, it is impacting their lives, isn't it?
Absolutely. And we see that choice paralysis a lot and that choice anxiety a lot with students, especially undergraduate students who are in this such prime part of their lives of discovering who they are, what their skills are, what they're good at. And they have limitless options for internships and jobs and where to move. And I think one of the core issues here is that they feel like there is a right and a wrong way to do life and to do things. And so they really are tormented. What is the right choice? What is the right and the best way to do this? Rather than having confidence, whatever road I choose, it'll be great and it'll be okay. And I'll be able to find something worthwhile down that road. So I think this is really a special time in students' lives of realizing what they're capable of moving through and what is important. And it doesn't have to be this limitless choices that are really causing them a lot of anxiety.
You know, Lori, I think one of the most interesting things about people is our ability to adapt, the human spirit. We can adapt to all kinds of situations. But in a negative sense, I know that you talk about adaptation and how, you know, you can kind of get used to feeling good, therefore you want to feel even better, even though that's not in your own best interest.
Yeah, I mean, the flip side is the good thing we were just talking about, where, you know, something terrible can happen to me, and, you know, I can lose the use of my legs, and I'll adapt. The downside is that that's true for the good stuff, too. You know, I can hit the lottery and get used to having that much money. I can meet the perfect partner and just kind of get bored in that relationship. And that suggests that what we need to do is to fight the adaptation when we're becoming adapted to the good stuff. And we can do that in a few very concrete ways. One is just taking time to experience the gratitude that you have for the things that are going well in your life. You know, the fact that you have a salary that can put a roof over your head, or the fact that you have children that you love very much. Another technique researchers talk about is what's called negative visualization, the quick act of experiencing what life would be like if you didn't have that. I often do this in my lectures with parents. I say, parents, you know, imagine the last time you saw your child. What if that was the last time you were ever going to see him or her again? You know, and you imagine whatever terrible scenario you want. But even just that one, you know, 2 seconds of thinking that will allow you to hug your kids a little bit more strongly the next time you see them and appreciate them a little bit more. It just takes a little work, but we can fight our own adaptation to the good things in our lives.
Yeah, and Tracy, are young people getting that lesson that happiness is work? It requires daily practices, as Lori said, gratitude, kindness. Are they recognizing that, and are they willing to put the work in?
Certainly. I think, and they're learning via making different choices and seeing those different outcomes happen, right? So I talk to students about data collection on their own lives. So as they're navigating this and they try something out, what if I choose this? Or what if I approach it with this mindset? And they're learning real time in these college and graduate school years all these lessons. And it's really wonderful to be able to witness that and support them through that. But, you know, we can read about these studies and the evidence, but without really absorbing it. And so what I think was so powerful about Lori's class was that students were actually asked to try out these things so that they can learn for themselves in real time, not just have a cognitive understanding, but really learn through their own experience. And that is most valuable.
And Lori, you're getting ready to go into season 2 of the Happiness Lab. What's ahead for us all?
Yeah, so in the next 4 weeks, we have a set of New Year's episodes, kind of New Year, New You, where we talk to experts about really specific strategies you can use to put your new goals into effect in this new year and even this new decade. In season 2, we're tackling even harder things. We're going to talk about things like politics and happiness. You know, we're entering a big election year, and I think that's a lot of the reason some folks are anxious. So we're going to talk about what research suggests about how you can be in some kind of political environment that's really polarized and still experience happiness. We're going to talk about how you can increase empathy and sort of even promote different social connections. So it should be a very fun set of episodes. And season 2 will launch early in April.
And in 15 seconds, how do you sum up finding happiness, Lori?
It takes work. It takes work. But if you put in the work, you really can improve your well-being.
And what about you, Tracy? If a young freshman came to you not feeling good about where they were, very briefly, what kind of a brief conversation would you have with them in terms of trying to improve their outlook?
I would say know that you can get through all things, and you are not alone in doing that, and you are so supported, and we have all these tools that we know can help.
And there are so many resources out there. We want to thank both of you for joining us today. This has been, it's been It's made me happy. I don't know. Dr. Lori Santos is professor of psychology at Yale University and host of the Happiness Lab podcast. And Tracy George is the director of the Yale Well Initiative and the Good Life Center on campus. Thank you both again. Now, the Happiness Lab can be found on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play. Give it a listen. And while you're there, stream future shows of the full story as well. Well, that's going to be it for our show. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Our associate producers are Fatu Sangari, Roberto Rojas, and Sabrina Garone. Carrie Frank is our digital editor. J.D. Allen is our producer. And Terry Sheridan is our news director. And I'm Rebecca Sarand, filling in for Ron Ropiak. Thank you for being part of today's full story.